You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the Spanish-American War broke out, Joseph Hearst sent Frederick Remington, the celebrated illustrator, to Cuba to draw pictures of the conflict. When Remington telegraphed Hearst to complain that nothing was happening, Hearst was said to have replied, "You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war." Countless stories and media critics have referred to this event ever since, noting the power journalism has to start wars and mislead the public. The only problem is it never happened. W. Joseph Campbell, a professor in the School of Communication at American University, has compiled 9 similar media myths in his book, Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. It's published by the University of California Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Campbell to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
So how did the public come to believe that Hearst had sent that telegram?
Well, the story sort of has 2 phases to it. One, the original phase, the anecdote about you furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war, appeared in a memoir in 1901 by a reporter who used to do a lot of work for William Randolph Hearst. And he presented this anecdote as a compliment to Hearst and his forward-looking anticipatory journalism, the yellow journalism, that he was practicing in New York City at the turn of the 20th century. So it was meant as a compliment at first, but over the years, particularly in the mid-1930s and early 1940s, when Hearst was at the end or nearing the end of his career and was taking on Franklin D. Roosevelt as a real threat to American society, sort of calling him Moscow's candidate for president and things like that, that folks in defense of FDR called attention to William Randolph Hearst's warmongering ways. And this anecdote, you furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war, was unearthed essentially in the mid-1930s and became an anecdote that pointed to Hearst as a malignant warmonger and became widely known. And it was really sealed, the popularity of this anecdote was really sealed in 1941 with the motion picture Citizen Kane.
Well, didn't Hearst or Remington ever object to the story during their lifetimes?
Hearst certainly did. And on a couple of occasions denied it, that it ever had happened, that he had ever sent such a message.
But nobody believed
Remington. And no one believed him. Remington, oddly enough, never really publicly discussed this, at least as far as I can determine. And he had ample opportunities because Remington lived until 1909. As I said, the anecdote first appeared in a memoir in 1901. And so it's a bit of a mystery as to why Remington never addressed it, perhaps because it wasn't such a prominent or big deal in the early 20th century. It only took on the dimension and the malignancy that it acquired in the mid-1930s.
You call these misreported stories journalism myths and call them the junk food of the profession. Why do you think they have such long lives?
Well, there's a number of reasons why they take hold and are widely reported and widely retold. One is that they're like junk food. They are delicious. They're alluring. They're savory. They're enticing, almost too good to resist. But in the end, of course, they're not necessarily nourishing or especially healthy. But more than that, they offer simplistic answers to complex issues. They have a way of reducing history and historical events to very digestible morsels. And so the simplistic nature of most of these media myths is an important factor as to why they take hold and why they live on. And they also underscore the inclination of the news media or the belief that the news media are powerful forces in American society, powerful for good or bad. And a number of these myths, including the one that you mentioned about Hearst and Remington and the famous Furnish the War anecdote, demonstrate how the news media can be, in this case, bad for society, that they are dangerous forces sometimes.
But you also talk about
the power of the news media.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the power of the news media, the presumed power of the news media, is an important factor in why these myths are so widely well entrenched.
But you also are suggesting there's a power in the popular culture because Orson Welles' Citizen Kane reinforced this myth. And one of the other misreported stories you touch on is Orson Welles' 1938 broadcast of War of the Worlds, which was said to inspire mass panic. And we have a clip from that to play.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Ramon Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York.
So why do you think people fell for the radio program as truth in the first place?
Well, the program made very imaginative and effective use of news bulletins, of bulletins that interrupted the regularly scheduled program. And Americans by 1938 had become accustomed to that, to having their radio programs interrupted by breaking news stories. And Orson Welles, who was 23 years old at the time he did the War of the Worlds dramatization, used that technique very effectively. And it made for great radio, great entertainment. Surveys after the show, indicated very clearly that most listeners realized what they were listening to, that it was a radio show. It was a radio dramatization. Most of them recognized for what it was. Only a small number of people were frightened or scared or disturbed by what they had heard. And even then, even a minority of people who were frightened or disturbed, that's a very long way from the notion that mass panic and hysteria seized the United States that night across the country from New York to San Francisco.
But wasn't,
there's just simply no evidence for that.
But wasn't there an academic study decades later that confirmed the fact that the broadcast created mass panic?
I believe the study you're referring to was done by a Princeton academic named Cantrill, and his study came out fairly soon after the dramatization, 1940, 1941, and his data clearly show that most people recognized the show for what it was, radio entertainment. And nonetheless, he proceeded to try to make the case that there was mass panic, nationwide hysteria that night. So the research, while innovative in some respects, was also very misleading. And newspaper coverage of the time did not give many details. The coverage in the aftermath of the program relied heavily on anecdotes from across the country of people who were upset, disturbed, who may have run into the streets or headed for the hills. But those anecdotes, as interesting as they may be, do not add up to the notion that there was mass panic, widespread hysteria that night. And had the program caused that kind of reaction, had it caused mass hysteria and widespread panic, deaths and injuries, serious injuries, surely would have been associated with that. And newspaper reporting in the aftermath shows that there were no deaths associated with that event, no suicides, no serious injuries.
My guest is W. Joseph Campbell, professor in the School of Communication at American University, and the author of a number of books. The one we're discussing is Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. The next misreported story about journalism that you highlight is Edward R. Murrow's legendary March 9, 1954 See It Now broadcast, in which he took on Joseph McCarthy. The program is often cited as the event that led to McCarthy's downfall. Let's hear a clip from that show.
No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind as between the internal and the external threats of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular.
Those are pretty strong words. Why do you think the broadcast wasn't as influential as the myth would have it?
Largely because Edward R. Murrow came very late to taking on Joe McCarthy. By March 1954, McCarthy's favorability ratings with the American public had hit the skids. They were in decline. They were in clear decline. By then, Americans realized what kind of toxic threat that Joe McCarthy posed to the country. They did not need a white knight like Edward R. Murrow to tell them of this threat. Journalists, including muckraking journalists such as Drew Pearson, had been reporting on Joe McCarthy for years, and identifying just what kind of bully this guy was, how thin his evidence of his communist and government witch hunt really was. So by March 1954, Edward R. Murrow is very late to taking on McCarthy. And interestingly, Murrow himself said as much, that he did not deserve the credit, he said, for bringing down McCarthy, the fact that he was very late to do so.
It's often been described as a very brave act. You're suggesting it wasn't all that brave because others had done it and hadn't been hurt by it. But didn't it lead to his being defanged to a large degree by Bill Paley in the years that followed?
That this program led to Murrow's being defanged.
Yeah. After that, he really was just he was kind of sidelined, and was wound up doing shows in which he visited people's homes.
Actually, those programs were underway simultaneously with his See It Now reporting, and his being sidelined, Murrow's being sidelined, did not happen in the immediate aftermath or because of his taking on Joe McCarthy. That happened later. His sponsor, the Aluminum Company of America, Alcoa, remained with the See It Now program for more than a year after the show on McCarthy. So the notion that this program did a lot of harm to Edward R. Murrow is misleading.
What about the other side of the story? I was surprised to read about the selective editing that Murrow and his staff engaged in order to make the program more effective. You mentioned that his team gathered over 15,000 hours of tape and whittled that down to 30 minutes. Do you think that was irresponsible, or is that all that different than what happened recently with the video that Andrew Breitbart posted about Shirley Sherrod?
Well, I do think it's different, and I think that in a 30-minute program, Murrow's program in March 1954 was good advocacy journalism. It wasn't even handed journalism. It was to zero in on McCarthy and identify the threats that he was posing to the United States and to the government and society. I mean, McCarthy's communist and government witch hunt had been going on for a number of years, and it had in many respects a deleterious effect. And so Murrow did a fine job. He and his staff did a fine job of assembling very telling moments about McCarthy and McCarthy in action, showing very clearly his tactics, the innuendo, the bullying tactics, and so forth that characterized McCarthy's witch hunt. I think it was good advocacy journalism. I wouldn't put it in the same category at all as Breitbart's recent work. And Murrow gave McCarthy a chance to respond, and McCarthy took that opportunity three or four weeks later on CBS and did not do himself much good at all in that response. In fact, it really hurt McCarthy even further. And so it was a good moment of advocacy journalism, but it came very late. It came years after other journalists had reported critically about McCarthy, his record, and his techniques.
So why do you think it has grown to hold such – stature in the history of the medium?
I think it's there are a number of reasons, one of which is that I believe that television at the time and afterward needed a seminal moment, a pivotal moment, needed an occasion such as this, in which Murrow showed a lot of courage in taking on McCarthy. And I think for that reason that this myth has taken hold and lives on. And Murrow to this day is recognized as the patron saint of broadcast journalism in this country.
My guest is W. Joseph Campbell. His latest book, Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. It's published by the University of California Press. We'll continue look at some of the other misreported stories after we take a little break. Stay with us.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance the military and political analysts are right, in the next few months, we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.
That was from a February 1968 broadcast, the so-called Cronkite moment, which was said to have inspired President Johnson to say that if he lost Walter Cronkite, he lost Middle America. I'm talking with W. Joseph Campbell. It's one of the stories that he writes about in his new book called Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism, published by the University of California Press. That was pretty strong stuff, Professor Campbell. And at that time, there was no Fox Network, so people must have been shocked.
it's interesting. It's really was unremarkable for the time. For late February 1968, Cronkite's mired in stalemate assessment was not remarkable. It was not extraordinary. Other news outlets had been describing the war in Vietnam in such terms for weeks and months before. In fact, in the summer of 1967, the New York Times ran a front-page story under the headline, Signs of Stalemate, that described just how difficult the situation in Vietnam had become for the U.S. military. And a few days before, 3 or 4 days before Cronkite's show, the Wall Street Journal, in an editorial, said that we better be prepared for the bitter taste of defeat in Vietnam. So commentators and analysts on both sides, on both ends of the political spectrum, were recognizing just how difficult the situation had become. Plus, Lyndon Johnson, who, as you mentioned, supposedly watched the program and made this remark to aides in the aftermath, Lyndon Johnson pretty clearly was not at the White House that night. He was not in front of a television set. He was in Austin, Texas, speaking at the 51st birthday party of Governor John Conley. At the time that Cronkite was intoning his mired in stalemate comment, Johnson was making lighthearted remarks about Conley's turning 51, saying something to the effect of, well, today, John, you've reached the number that all politicians aim for, a simple majority. And it may not have been the best or funniest joke ever told by a politician, but nonetheless, Johnson clearly is not saying, woe is us, I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. And in the days and weeks after the Cronkite show, Johnson is in public speeches is urging America to recommit to a successful conclusion in Vietnam. So even if Johnson had seen the program on videotape afterwards, it clearly represented no epiphany for him. It did not change American policy. It did not change Johnson's outlook. And the funny thing about many media-driven myths is how sometimes the principles themselves dispute the notion that their program or their article or their reporting had much of an effect. And that was the case with Walter Cronkite. For many years afterwards, he said, and this includes his memoir, which came out in the mid-1990s, he said things to the effect of, well, I don't believe this program had much of an impact. It was like another straw on the back of a crippled camel. It was only very late in Cronkite's life that he came to embrace the notion that that show in February 1968 did have a powerful effect.
Who was the first, then, to ascribe such importance to the broadcast? How did the myth grow over time?
It's a very interesting question, and it's a bit murky. We do know that David Halberstam, the late David Halberstam, mentioned the anecdotes in his book, The Powers That Be. But he did not put the quote that's often attributed to Cronkite inside quotation marks. So he's paraphrasing it. But over the years, that quote has taken hold. And in fact, there's a lot of variability as to what Johnson supposedly said in response to the Cronkite show. If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the war. If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country. Versions like that, and there's so many versions as to what Johnson supposedly said, that, in my view, is another marker that this story is a media-driven myth, that it's almost certainly untrue.
My guest is W. Joseph Campbell, professor in the School of Communication at American University, the author of 5 books, the most recent one, Getting It Wrong, 10 of the greatest misreported stories in American journalism, published by California University of California Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the misreported stories that you discuss is the so-called crack baby story of the 1980s, where it was said that the children of women who smoke crack would be biologically inferior. How did that story first get reported?
It was a story that was reported across the political spectrum, that commentators on the right and the left seized upon this and described the potential for a bio-underclass, as one of the commentators described it, a bio-underclass that would take hold, that the offspring of women who had taken crack during their pregnancy would be doomed to lives of endless dependency and endless suffering. And there were some biomedical reports, research that had been done on the phenomenon of crack cocaine, but they were very preliminary. The size of the sample, the number of people participating in the study was very small. The authors of the study cautioned that this research should be replicated, and conclusions should not be drawn extensively from the preliminary research. But in large measure, journalists ran through such stop signs and described this social disaster that was in the making, supposedly, heedless, really, of the need for more detailed, solid, and sustained biomedical research. And many of the reports about crack babies, news reports about crack babies, were based on anecdote rather than sustained and solid and replicated scientific research. And there is, even to this day, no recognized medical syndrome known as the crack baby syndrome. There is something called the fetal alcohol syndrome, but nothing akin to the crack baby syndrome.
In fact, you point out that the negative impacts of alcohol and tobacco on fetuses were often overlooked when we were talking about these crack babies.
That's right. And sometimes these effects are very difficult to parse out. But nonetheless, women who were taking crack in many cases during their pregnancies also were abusing alcohol and smoking cigarettes, not getting very good prenatal care at all. And so that combination of factors really was led to cases that births of youngsters with low birth weight and other maladies that became lumped into this so-called crack baby syndrome, which really doesn't exist.
Well,
but nonetheless, the term was so appealing in a perverse way that it took hold, and it's still used today. It's still used to this day.
Well, the Senate recently passed a bill closing a loophole that punished users of crack more severely than users of cocaine, although they still are punished more severely. I suspect that this has something to do with that crack panic. But isn't it true that journalism often has difficulty reporting accurately on scientific research? And I wonder why that is.
That's a very good question, and you raise a very good point, and I think that's true. It's often very difficult. 25, 30, 35 years ago, news organizations were warning about the potential of global cooling and what global cooling would do to the Earth. And I think that anecdote-based reporting tends to magnify problems beyond their real sweep and scope. And I think and there's no getting away from anecdotal-driven reporting. But I think that reliance on anecdote tends to help explain why journalists often have trouble getting it right in scientific reporting.
But even when something is reported, sometimes it gets blown out of proportion, like the bra burning at the Miss America pageant in Atlantic City in 1968, an image that's come to haunt feminists, although many historians, like Susan Faludi, claim there's no evidence any undergarment was so much as singed during the protest. I think there were some bras burned, weren't there? But not exactly sure why that wound up being used to attack feminists.
It's an interesting and somewhat complicated story. I call it the nuanced myth in my book. And it does revolve around the women's liberation demonstration in September 1968 at the Miss America pageant. And the protest was organized to call attention to the degrading nature, supposedly, of that pageant. And the notion, the myth is that women in that protest ostentatiously set fire to their bras. There is no evidence that that is indeed the case. There is no evidence that women at that protest burned their bras in a fiery public spectacle on the boardwalk at Atlantic City. What my research has shown, though, and this stems from a reading of the local newspaper, which apparently had been overlooked by researchers for 30 years, apparently there was an attempt and bras were set on fire very briefly. What the protesters had done was to toss into a trash can, what they called the Freedom Trash Can, articles of what they called torture of women, girdles, high heels, bras, as well as copies of Cosmopolitan and Playboy magazines. My research shows that there was an attempt, however briefly, to set the contents of the Freedom Trash Can on fire. It sputtered out very briefly and didn't last very long. But nonetheless, there seems to have been an attempt to set them on fire. So the bras may have been singed, but they certainly were not burned and twirled over the heads of protesters in a public spectacle at Atlantic City. In fact, I think bras, even in 68, were pretty tough to set on fire.
Not easily. Finish your sentence. I'm sorry.
They're not easily set afire.
Now, all of these stories, and you have a few more in the book, have had long lives. Are we seeing shorter lives on the stories these days? The Jessica Lynch, for example, story was debunked fairly soon afterward. We did hear also about the Pat Tillman murder, killing, whatever you want to call it. Shirley Sherrod thing was turned around almost immediately, although the Acorn story continues to have some impact. Has the internet changed things a little bit, or has it become a disseminator of even more apocryphal stories?
Well, I think that the 10 myths that I debunk in getting it wrong do not represent the complete universe of media-driven myths. There are others out there, both historical and more recent, and more myths to be debunked. And I think the internet tends to be a double-edged sword. It can send out erroneous information very quickly, but it also has the ability to knock down, to debunk that information just as quickly. nonetheless, there are stories that have taken hold and live on to this day in the internet age, in the digital age. And the Jessica Lynch story, I mean, you're right, the Washington Post's erroneous story about Jessica Lynch's supposed battlefield heroics early in the Iraq War was knocked down very quickly. Even so, there are a lot of people today who believe Jessica Lynch is a hero, even though she denies and disputes the term. But what has lived on is what I call a subsidiary myth of the Jessica Lynch case, the notion that the U.S. military planted the story in order to boost morale for the conflict back home. And as one of the journalists for the Washington Post who reported that story later said, the Pentagon, the military, was not the source for his story. And there is really very little reason to believe the military would try to concoct a hero where there really was none. There was no reason to use made-up heroics about a young woman on the battlefield in Iraq to boost morale back home, because at the time, in early 2003, support for the war was, what, 75, 80, 85%? The war, hard as it may believe it is to believe today, had a lot of public support in its early days.
Are there any... go ahead, finish up.
So there are myths out there that are lingering, that are spin-off myths from already debunked myths, and I believe there are other myths to be taken on and debunked.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about the 10 that you have debunked, Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism, is published by the University of California Press, and I've been talking to its author, W. Joseph Campbell, a professor in the School of Communication at American University. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.